This was in Spotlight, Delaware this morning. Governor Meyer to defend a landmark corporate law against constitutional challenge. Carl Baker, June 6th. A constitutional challenge to Delaware's hard-fought corporate law change, which critics had decried as a billionaire's bill, is likely headed to the state Supreme Court after Governor Matt Meyer intervened in the case last week. In March, Meyer signed Senate Bill 21 into law following a bruising debate inside and out of the legislature. Meyer and other backers had called the bill a course correction, it's in quotes, for Delaware business courts, whose rulings, they said, had given small shareholders too much latitude in recent years to sue companies over decisions made by founders and other big shareholders. Such lawsuits regularly occur in Delaware's Court of Chancery because the state is the legal home to more than 2 million companies and about two-thirds of the Fortune 500 companies. In the months since SB 21 became law, several lawsuits have emerged in the state's business court challenging its constitutionality. Last week, Meyer formally intervened in one of the constitutional challenges in order to defend the new law. That case involves a plumbers union pension fund suing Dropbox Incorporated on claims that the tech company's recent move to Nevada from Delaware was a self-interested defense measure designed to quash lawsuits from mom-and-pop investors. Oh, baby, it's not possible. In the shadow of Rockford Tower, behind enemy lines, in the belly of the Delaware Way Beast, I'm Rob. This is the Highlands Bunker Podcast. Hello. Comrades and friends, we have what we promised for you today. Representative from Pike Creek, Frank Burns. Hello, Frank.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm doing fine. How are you today?
I'm doing wonderfully. Before we get into it, since I read the SB 21 thing, I'll just mention what I mentioned to some of your colleagues, Sophie Phillips, Medina Wilson-Anton, Ray Moore, the people who stood up against the billionaires bill, I think deserve a lot of credit because, we know what kind of environment was happening. We know that you had to listen to presentations from some of the most unscrupulous people in the state, self-interested capitalists in the state. So you had to sit through a lot of nonsense. But I appreciate you and your colleagues who did. So, standing up for, a plumber's union's right to, hold accountable companies that they've invested in. So thanks.
Well, I think there had been a program I do think a lot of people don't realize the methodologies that are used when there's a lot of money on the line, where they don't necessarily talk to an individual, but they get people to talk to their circle of friends. And so if you do that and you target the people you talk to in an influence campaign, you can start this, and I do think it became a hysteria over, oh no, all these companies are going to leave Delaware. So I'm not going to try to read anybody's mind about whether they were aware of this sort of the sky is falling type of thing, but I do think many, many people were manipulated into believing that and then thinking this is something they had to do. So I prefer to be gracious and give people the benefit of the doubt. As you know, that has not caused a lessening of companies leaving Delaware. It seems to be at that same pace or greater since the passage of SB 21. I can't read anyone's mind and know what their motivations were. But I do think it was a bad bill, and I'm glad that I voted against it.
Yeah, and I had talked to, I guess I won't name names, but I had talked to, for example, some people in the Senate who didn't really like the bill, but just thought maybe they didn't even buy into the scare campaign, or they weren't influenced like that. They weren't sort of like led down that path. But it was also like, do I want to take all of this heat if two people in the Senate are going to vote no, you know, because it's not going to mean anything. And I thought the same thing about the House, and that's why I give the folks in the House who did it probably, because you could have, the same result happened, and you could have saved yourself a lot of bullshit, you know, just sort of being like, there's nothing I can do about this, but sticking to your, you know, to what you think you should be doing, you know, is laudable. So thanks.
Well, thank you. But I mean, I wouldn't be in office if I didn't think I would be standing up for the things I believed were right. I mean, there are some things where you can be sort of equivocal and say, okay, I don't really know if this is good or bad. So, you know, I'm hemming and hawing. You get a lot of, you don't really have a firm idea of whether this is right or wrong. And I can see people being moving on that kind of an issue. But this is very clear. This was giving the huge multi-billionaire owners and controllers of corporations power over the small investors in a way that was morally reprehensible in my eye. You know, people got scared. And I do think fear works in politics.
Yeah, I mean, and that was the big thing. This is a huge portion of our revenue, and we're going to lose it all so fast. Like, you know, I, because the system is set up, this is the exact button that they could push, because it lines right up with everything everybody kind of wants to do. So it was actually fairly easy in a situation like this to run sort of a fear campaign and be like, oh, we're going to go bankrupt. Or there's a fiscal crisis around the corner, and you know Trump's in there, and he's pulling all this other federal money, so, you know, you got to do this, which, again, is, you know, it's just a con job, but, you know, I think you described it pretty well. You know, you can get to people, you can get to people on this stuff. This is actually exactly the kind of stuff that you can get to people on.
Absolutely, and think about it. If you do buy into the fear, and you think that if we don't pass this bill and Medicaid gets cut, we're not going to have the money to support the people in our state who need Medicaid. So I'm saying there can be people who, if people buy the fear, then their motivations may actually be quite, you know, within that, having accepted the fear argument, may be quite noble actually. You know, so I hate to try to read into anyone else's mind why they take a certain vote or why they do what they do.
The mind reading and commentary is for me. Only I do that.
Okay.
I'll take care of that bit. And then Carl will rein me in if I go too far. So I want to ask you a question that I ask a lot of people, because I'm just interested in it, but I'm even more interested because I know a little bit about your background and you coming to public service after a whole nother career, basically. Where did you grow up? What was it like? And how did you find yourself in the sciences as a man of science?
Okay. Do you want I'll try to give you the somewhat abbreviated answer.
You can give as much of an answer as you want. We have all day.
I grew up in Chicago in a community called East Rogers Park. We were poor when I was growing up, but I don't think I was aware we were poor. After my parents had passed away and going through the papers, I saw that I knew we had moved several times when I was a child. I didn't realize we'd been evicted several times when I was a child. But my mother had had almost no education. She went to school for a total of 20 days because her stepfather wouldn't allow her to go to school. She lived in rural Arkansas during the Depression. So she really pushed education for all of us. I did well in school. I ended up going to high school for most of my high school career to an Augustinian seminary up in Holland, Michigan, where, although there's, you know, this whole thing. We weren't buddies. He was a senior and I was a freshman. It was a small school.
So who is he? Who is he? Who are you referring to?
Bob Prevost, who's now Pope Leo.
So the way that we and you have to stop doing that because we need a way to basically say that you're best friends with the Pope.
No,
so you can't. You have to. You know, because I had a whole list of questions about whether the Pope was like a booze hound, whether he was big with the ladies. You know, I need all this info, all this dirt on the Pope.
No, I can tell you this was many years ago, and I can tell you my impressions of him were good. He was a compassionate, caring individual, but he was a serious, studious guy. He wasn't a jokester, you know, a guy like that. He was serious and compassionate. And, actually, at that time, the path I'd been thinking of taking was working in the missions in Peru, which is what he eventually actually did. When my senior in high school, a friend of mine got expelled. I wasn't happy about it. I made a lot of noise. The head of the school pulled me in and said he didn't want me discussing it with the other students anymore because I was getting them upset. So I called my parents and asked them to come get me. Then I thought this might have just been a personality conflict with that individual because he had just taken over as head of the school that year. It was in my senior year.
So you're 17, 18.
Yeah. And I will say this. I reacted to that very emotionally. It wasn't like my best buddy who got expelled, but I just the whole way it was done.
You just thought it was unfair.
It was unfair. And this was, and so I had this thing where, well, I can't just accept religious authority. So I'm out. And then, so I went back in for the first year of college into the seminary, again, Augustinian Seminary, which was at Villanova University. And Bob Prevost was there also.
I was going to say, he also went to Prevost.
Yeah.
Now, are you stalking the Pope at this point? Are you following the Pope around the country?
That's why I ran for legislation of Vatican City. Yeah. I didn't really interact with him much in college, but, you know, that's it. But like, it's someone I knew a long time ago. I have a basic impression of him, but it's not like we're buddies or, you know.
Yeah.
There's no rubbing off of, like, you know, halos or anything.
Gotcha. So how did you, so you still, although you had sort of an issue at the seminary, the high school seminary as a senior, you did move into another program at Villanova, Catholic University. So you're still sort of in that track.
Yeah.
How did you become a scientist from a Catholic liberation theology person and somebody who's going to go abroad?
Okay, so two things happened. I fell in love.
Okay.
That's one. Not really compatible with staying in the seminary. And two, as I started thinking about other options, it was right at the time when the moratorium on genetic engineering was lifted. And all of a sudden, all these recombinant DNA things were starting to be done. And I just thought, well, I can make a contribution as a scientist. So that was, I went into science. And I do really love science. It interests me. So
you were always, even in your theological religious studies, you're still, you know, sort of a science guy. You knew sort of like this is this sort of genetic stuff, this sort of human science, cellular science, whatever you want to call it. That was like something that interested you even as a younger student.
Yeah,
that's cool.
So, and you know, Gregor Mendel was an Augustinian, so that was always sort of the
That's right. He was an Augustinian monk. Yeah.
So that was always sort of, you know, in the back of my mind that, you know, it was possible to be in a religious life and be a scientist.
Yeah. So do you finish at Villanova or do you go elsewhere?
I left the seminary, but I finished at Villanova. Then I went to Penn an NIH fellowship at Penn for graduate school. So staying at Villanova was tough financially. So that it was a struggle, but you know, I would like to think that there are other people that have struggled harder than I have. to achieve an education. So I don't want to overplay that.
Yeah. Well, Villanova remains rather expensive, as a matter of fact.
Well, it was at the time Basic Educational Opportunity Grant. It was now called the Pell Grants. So what is now a Pell Grant? I had a National Merit Scholarship, and I worked and I took out a lot of student loans, which I paid off in my mid-40s, by the way. Just so you know, the student loan debt thing is very real to me. So.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. You talk to people who paid off their student loan. They're like, well, I did it. Well, that's not really a good reason. Yeah. Like, I don't want to put this burden on other people for no reason. And I talk to people maybe even a little older than us, like my parents, who went to school at state schools for nominal cost, really. Yeah. I mean, at this point, you would look at that and say it's a nominal cost, and we just don't have, that doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah. You used to be able to make enough money when they were going to school over the summer to pay for your tuition, which you just cannot do in this day and age. It's impossible.
So the reason it sort of is interesting to me is because you had a full career as a scientist and sort of moved into public service or thought about it. I mean, that's a great question. Had you always sort of thought this is something you could do? I mean, obviously you were thinking about doing some of the most important service you can think of and going to the global South and working with, indigenous people, for example, in Peru. So you kind of always had that. You always had that in you. And so did that lead you to think after your career, this is something, I can get involved in public service and this is what I'd like to try to do?
Well, it was a journey there. And it was really, I could not believe the false narratives that were being put out there about climate change. And it is an existential crisis. And everyone sort of buries their head in the sand, and right now we're worried about, what Trump is doing today. But it is probably the biggest crisis facing humanity right now. Although, and it's like watching a slow train wreck where no one's willing to stand up and do anything about it. And I have to say, I got really excited about Bernie Sanders' 2016 run, and volunteered. I'd volunteered on and off on campaigns before that, but never with such a strong, visceral feeling about it. And then when the protest was going on at the Dakota Access Pipeline, after around Thanksgiving, when they sprayed the protesters in below freezing weather and put them at risk, I'd been scuba diving, so I took my wetsuits, packed them in my car, drove out to North Dakota, donated them to the Ocheticequon camp, and then stayed for a couple weeks helping build shelters for the people who were staying for the winter. But that used up my vacation time, so I went back to DuPont, where I was working at the time. And DuPont and I parted ways about a year later. So I started my own little company, which I still have, but it's not completely mothballed, but it's semi-mothballed now while I'm serving in the legislature.
Cool. So you're not a stranger to sort of like the ins and outs, because you had run before. When we first met, there was a challenge of your first election, the first time you ran with Mike Ramone. And I don't know if I told you, but I know I told Carl. I remember meeting you during that, and just your sort of demeanor, like I knew that you were the person for this. Like you were gonna be good, and I thought a lot of that had to do with the fact that you had already done tons of stuff with your life. This wasn't something that was going to overwhelm you. This sort of like petty infighting and things that are going to happen sort of in the political landscape. And so, yeah, I was so glad. And we kind of knew, we were like, yeah, you had it the next time. And so we were very glad that you were able to take your seat in Dover, as much as maybe you're reconsidering it now, but.
No, I'm not reconsidering it. I think we've gotten, I look at, if nothing else, the fact that I was able to be the 21st vote that got end-of-life options over the line. We had exactly 21 votes, the minimum needed, and Mike Ramone had voted against it. So I knew, you know, if I'd done nothing else but just done that to get that one piece of legislation through, I'd feel it would have been worth all the effort that went into being elected.
Yeah. Well, this is a good place to, I guess, start the conversation then, because I don't know if you're familiar with it, but there's something happening that I call the Working Families Party Derangement Syndrome. Are you familiar with the Working Families
Party Derangement Syndrome? Oh, yeah. I've listened to it several times. You know, yes.
How is that? I'm really, you know, it's difficult to talk to people about it who are sort of living it. But it's very obvious, you know, just a few weeks ago, I guess it was around the time that Ray Moore was removed from her committee seat. Kim Williams, of all people, gave a quote to a media organization about, well, of course, like, these people are going to be mad. They're Working Families Party. They all stick together. And my first thought was, like, that's like a weird thing to say. And my second thought was, you're goddamn right. That's how it's going to work. So it was just interesting to see. That was maybe the first time, of course, I knew it was happening for, you know, ever since Carl started doing his work, really. But it was the first time I had seen it sort of mentioned in public in the media.
Yeah.
Like that. So, yeah, it's just, it's very frustrating. It really should be frustrating for anybody, even if they don't. Even if you're just a progressive or you're just sort of an active, you know, a person in the Democratic Party who wants to do something, the people who want to do something are the most disliked people, you know, in the political realm of the state house. And I always found that very strange.
Well, I think, like I say, I try to not read intentions into other people's actions. So I'll just say, I think there is a fear among a lot of the candidates or a lot of the legislators that a Working Families Party challenger might unseat them.
Well, a Working Families Party challenger will very likely unseat them. Well, I mean, that's the way things are going. But the issue is, here's the part where I don't understand. Obviously, I understand that. So if you're a political, you're a politician and you're a state senator or a house rep or whatever, and you're like, well, I'm getting all of this pressure to do like these, to do this stuff. Wouldn't you just, if you felt that, wouldn't you just start doing some of it?
I would, but just, I don't.
Like, isn't that how politics is supposed to work? Like, if you're getting electoral pressure and constituent pressure about wanting to do these things that you really hadn't considered before, wouldn't the first priority to consider like which one of those you would start doing?
Yeah, I think one of the things that people, every legislator has to own their votes, right? I mean, you just do. If I make a bad vote, I have to own it. What happens is there's this sort of, I think it's almost like, you know, if you have a big flock of birds and they're all moving together, no one can pick out one to be the prey. I think that there's sometimes this kind of thinking process within a political party where you think if we're all in lockstep, then no one can pick one of us out to like say we could be targeted. I just think people need to follow their conscience and do the right thing. And, you know, sometimes that means you don't go with the swarm just because there's this mentality that if, you know, we all swarm together, then none of us are vulnerable.
Yeah, you're definitely vulnerable. You know, that's goes without saying. The other thing is you could all just start moving in a different direction. You know, you could all do it. Or everybody could at least consider a way to say, yeah, there's a very energized base. This energized base are a lot of my constituents. I'm in a position where I've made deals with other people who have already lost their seats. So maybe I can find some way to sort of massage my policy positions in a way that will show that I'm actually being I'm looking at the political winds and trying to capture that as a politician and say, what's popular? What do people want? I can try to do that. But they look at that and they think it's like an insult to them that people want something different. Like, they're personally insulted by the fact that there are constituents and activists in their communities and in their districts that are asking for something different or demanding something different. Like, that's some kind of personal affront to them.
Yeah.
When that's how fucking politics works.
Yeah.
So that's the thing that I find it, I mean, it's mildly amusing because I don't have to deal with it the way you have to deal with it. So I can make a comedy show out of it. But it is very weird to me.
Yeah.
That if you are that concerned about holding your seat and holding political power and being, you know, the honorable so-and-so or whatever, then, you know, figure out a way to make it work. It's not our fucking fault. You know?
Yeah, I agree. And I actually, you know, probably a lot of people in the would find this strange, but I think a lot of, if you want to call them mainstream Democrats, I would encourage them to actually seek out the Working Family Party endorsement. Because I do think some of them are not that far off that they would not get backed by the Working Families Party, but they've already decided that the Working Families Party is, you know, the person they're in opposition to, as opposed to reaching out and saying, hey, you know, consider me, because you might, you know, we're going to disagree about some things, but I'm solid on a lot of things that you agree with also. So, I mean, it might sound like the strangest of propositions, but I would encourage people to, rather than just assume someone's going to be running against you backed by the World Working Families Party, go through the process. See if the Working Families Party will back you and try to understand what you could do to maybe get that backing.
Yeah, I mean, at least a little bit of like professional curiosity. Be like, well, what is it that you're trying to do? Well, we're trying to do this stuff. Well, we can work with that maybe. And even if you don't go, even if you don't want to be labeled as that because your friends will be mad or something, you would think you would at least, again, just consider the policy package and be like, where can I fit in here? How can I protect myself from getting a primary, which you're going to get because none of them are doing this. But the best way for me to protect myself from getting a primary is to listen to the policy proposals and see if there's any way you can help do something with these. But I don't think that they want to. That's the biggest thing. You and I probably differ about this. I actually think that sort of Democrat that you're talking about, which, again, there's a lot of them that might consider themselves progressive or whatever, I actually think they're not. I think they're a bunch of fakos. But you're not someone who makes those. You don't make those jumps.
I can't see inside anyone else's heart or mind.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to make any assumptions about, you know, whether they're coming from, you know, a place of genuineness or, you know, deceitfulness. I can't know that.
Yeah. I mean, I don't even know if I would call it deceit. I think for some people, I certainly would. But I think it's more like, you know, we have a set of interests, and it's really actually better for us to just keep taking the money from the people we take it from, which for a lot of people is only, you know, a few like special interest groups. And if we just can continue to do that, we can continue to be like, we'll have our name in the paper, and we'll be able to go to all of these events, and people will want to take their photo with us and all of this stuff. And I think it's a real, again, I understand you're not wanting to make assumptions or look into anybody's mind. What I'm saying is, what I've seen is, I'm looking at people's behavior, the things that they say and the things that they do. Now, again, that doesn't necessarily equate to one thing, but I'm not trying to do anything other than look at what people say and what they do, and judge them on that, and on that. These people are failures. So whether they're genuine or not, or whether they're sincere and they just don't know, I'm like you. I'm not sure, but to me, it doesn't matter. It doesn't really matter what you think in your head and in your heart that I don't know. It really matters what you do. And if you don't do it, you got to go.
Yeah, and that's why I say you own your votes, you own your actions, you own what you do. And, you know, if you are sincere to who you are, then you should just be able to do that and not, you know, if I realize there's some people that just want to hold on to their seat because maybe, and this, I thought about this, it actually reminds me of some of the people in the seminary who you had people, and I will put the former Pope in the first group, who they're sincere in their devotion and what they want to do. And then I saw other people continuing on because they had majored in philosophy in college, and there was really, they didn't see, they were, and they'd lived in, it's a sort of a communal lifestyle, the Augustinian is an order, and sort of losing that support of the community, and then, you know, going out with a degree in philosophy. I think a lot of, there were some people, I won't say a lot, but some who continued on only because they really don't know what else they would do. And I think that's probably true of some people in politics as well.
And I guess I understand that. I mean, even coming from the corporate world where I came from, even myself, you know, I did a lot of stuff I didn't want to do because I didn't see any other, like, this is the job I got. This is the industry that I have experience in. And so I just have to keep going along. But that's a different, but I guess people don't really appreciate the fact that this doesn't really work like that. Like, you can continue to do that, but you will get beat by the Working Families Party if you're not agile enough or savvy enough to figure out what people in your district want. If you think you're going to tell them what they want and they don't think that, you're going to lose.
Yeah.
And that's the difference, is like, you could actually, if you think this is the only thing you know how to do, or this is what you want to keep, the actual way to keep that isn't how to keep it at Chase or Wells Fargo or some other place I worked. Keep your head down. Don't say anything, you know, whatever. Here, you're in the spotlight. And so you have to make decisions to keep yourself on that path if that's what you want to do. Because the fact is, that's the way elections work. People get to go out and tell you whether you're any good or not. And so that's the part that I always struggle with, is like, I understand the proclivity to want to keep your head down and just do the things you always did to stay in that track, for lack of a better word.
Yeah.
But this doesn't work like that.
Yeah.
And then, you know, so it's just like, I don't know what to tell you.
Yeah, I don't think it should work like that. I'm just telling you what I see when I look around.
Yeah,
I'm not. I'm not promoting that.
Right. No. I feel that. I have a question, and you might not know this, but it kind of leads to a bigger question. But I know this, that the end of life stuff had been really on the docket for a decade or more. Paul Baumbach was one of his sort of. His things he would always try to do every year, and he was there for the signing and all that. I saw his picture. He's a nice guy. Is there any, and I know Paul and other advocates for this have worked long in the community and gotten people's stories, you know, people who have been ill and they're going to die. You know, that's just the way that it works. And so do we know roughly how many people would fit the category for something like this, and then and also how many people we expect to consider and go through this process, maybe like on a yearly basis? Do we have any idea?
I can't give you a number. I think I'm not sure how many people get a diagnosis where they know they're going to die as opposed to pass suddenly. I really don't know what that breakdown is. But anyone who has a diagnosis that's terminal could potentially avail themselves of this. So, and I think that as we are, you know, one of the terms that people used a lot in this who were against it, they would say natural death. Well, every time we give someone a shock with a AED or do life-saving surgery, we prevented a natural death. So, you know, it's not like medicine doesn't intervene in sort of quote natural death on a daily basis. But I think more people now sort of know when they're going. But a lot of people, if you have dementia, you're diminished capacity, you can't avail yourself of this in any event. So
the reason, and this is why I asked. A year or two ago, I spoke with the previous state treasurer, Colleen Davis. And one of the things in our conversation she mentioned that she was sort of proud of that the treasurer's office does is one of the programs is for children in state care, like foster care. If children age out of foster care in Delaware, there's a mechanism by which the state will pay for their housing and college tuition. I was like, well, that sounds pretty good. But I was like suspicious of it because I thought, you know, you're talking about this like this great thing. I'm going to go back over the last, say, dozen years and try to figure out how many people this is. And over like 10 years, I think the most there ever was in 1 year was 4. So I'm certainly glad that for those dozen or two dozen people who were in that situation, they got the help they needed. But, you know, you look at stuff and you're like, are we really going to have a 12 or 15 year debate over end of life? I'm interested to see what the impact of that is. If people can really if there are people that take advantage of it. I mean, obviously if anybody takes advantage of it and that's what they want to do and they have a terminal diagnosis, they should. And I'm glad that they will, because I think that I agree with you on the policy of it. I see this stuff in Delaware. A lot of it has to do with like means testing. It's like the Kim Williams, like, well, we can give lunch to like a third of a student, or we can do like, we argue and argue and argue for fucking decades. Same with cannabis. Argued about it for 13 years. There's still no way to buy recreational cannabis in Delaware. So it's just like, do people really think they're accomplishing anything? I mean, I know Carl and I argue about this all the time, because I'm sort of like, I notice every time a bill gets signed, there's you know, several people crowding around the governor with big shit-eating grins on their face, and I look and I'm like,
One of those people sometimes. By the way,
everybody is.
I have to own up that I do that. So.
Yeah, everybody does. Yeah. No, this is you know, everybody does. I don't. I mean, I don't even think that would be a situation where I would be even invited, but I wouldn't go if I was. But yeah, it's just like, wow, we did it. Well, what did we do? Should there be yes, the bill passed. Yes, I hope that however many dozens of people this might impact in the next 5 years, I'm glad for it. I don't know whether we had to argue about it for 15 years. It's like 1 year of argument for every person who takes advantage of it. It just seems like there's a lot of backslapping and victory laps for not many victories.
Yeah. Well, I'll put it in a personal context on the end of life option. So in 2021, I had 3 surgeries for metastatic cancer. After each surgery, they kick you out of the hospital pretty quick and they give you pain medication to take at home. I never took a single one of those pain medications at home. I froze them. Because I'd seen my father die a very protracted, very painful death. So what this bill does for me is allow me to dispose of the medicine I had frozen in my freezer. And I can't believe I'm the only one in Delaware that's been thinking that way. So I don't know how many people will actually avail themselves of it, but it takes away a concern.
No, and again, I don't want the broader point to get sort of confused with what I'm trying to say. Whoever takes advantage, sort of like the 18-year-olds who age out of foster care and have nothing, like however many it is, if it's 2, that program is good. That's not really the issue. The issue is that we could be doing a lot more. We celebrate doing sometimes not even the bare minimum, and then we have to argue about that for a decade. And I think people, I think the standard that people are, that representatives and senators and the state government should be judged by should be much higher. I'll put it that way. I think we judge, our standards are, I mean, we barely have any. To me, now Carl will obviously disagree. But yeah, that I think that's my problem, is not the specifics, but the idea that we're holding everybody to, like, basically no standard, just do whatever. I mean, you could argue about it for 15 years and we still don't. You still take it as a personal affront if we think we're going to try to primary you. You know, you haven't done anything in 15 years. What, you know, why would you think that we would be okay with that?
Yeah,
it's certainly a broader point than the people who would be impacted by that. And I will say, I can assure you, you're not the only person who's thought that way. You know, I know people who have done sort of similar stuff. Like, if the time comes, we're going to have to do X, Y, or Z thing.
Yeah. Well, part of it is we have such a, at least in the legislature, we have such a conservative culture about trying to do anything. You know, there's people won't move ahead with something if there's any reasonably funded or organized group against it. Oftentimes, they will not move forward with bills. They will pull bills if, you know, group A, B, or C or whatever comes out against it. People don't have courage. I mean, I'll never forget the first time I met Medina Wilson Anton was at a Network Delaware training for candidates and people that wanted to work on campaigns. And I was there as a person to work on a campaign. And actually, Medina and Larry Lambert were both there, you know, as candidates. And what she mentioned was that the person she was running against would wait to see which way everyone was voting before deciding how to vote. So, you know, that was Viola. And, you know, that the lack of courage. And actually, I have to say, you know, she has become one of the most courageous state legislators I've ever been aware of. I mean, you know, in terms of not backing down and saying what she believes in and being able to be vocal about it. You know, and Eric Morrison has done that as well to a large extent. And, you know, Eric Morrison had the former Speaker of the House out working at the polls, you know, poll greeting for his primary opponent. So
didn't work.
No, it didn't work.
Didn't work.
And, you know, so one of the things that comes up is, well, unity, we shouldn't be endorsing or working for anyone who's running against another caucus member. But that's not the way things have been done historically. If you're not in with the sort of, this was under Pete, so I'm going to, you know, and this is, we're now two speakers away from Pete, but, you know, the history has not been one of, you know, don't challenge another incumbent legislator.
Yeah, incumbency is a, it's sort of like a cheat word for something else. It's like the people who are the status quo, sort of, because, you know, famously Schwarzkopf had no issue with many Republicans from downstate. You know, incumbency just meant, like you said, look, we got this thing on lockdown. We have to barely do anything. The standards are low. You know, we're arguing about tax brackets and end of life care and school lunches ad nauseum every year, round and round and round and round. And so as long as we can keep that thing going, that's really that's what the incumbency is. If you're an incumbent who doesn't do that and does something else, then, you know, you're not really an incumbent. You know, they're gonna look for people to run against you. And that's the thing too, is just like the establishment Democrats have done this for fucking ages. Pete himself looked for people to run against, you know, more progressive people that were already incumbents. You know, that's just how it is. It happened in North Wilmington. The people wanted Larry Lambert. Ray Siegfried got beat. Then what happens? Well, they put him in his position anyway through special election. So, yeah, my thing is that people just need to understand that that's all part of the game. You don't need to fall into that. You don't need to buy into that at all, because that's the other big problem that I feel like the movement has had and the project has had, is that people get absorbed into it And that's been a big problem. But again, I fall back on sort of like the people that get absorbed in it are a certain kind of person. A person who has had a career in the sciences, a successful career, and has a background in theology and philosophy, and who's, you know, an established person. You're not the type of person who is going to get sort of tricked by that. Do you know what I mean?
I hope not. I don't think
you don't
I am,
seem to
I,
be.
I haven't, as far as I know, I haven't so far. And if I ever do, call me on it.
Oh, we will. Okay. We've talked about this actually.
We'll good.
Call you right up. So like a last sort of big question, like some specifics, like stuff that's going on now, I would love for you to talk about the wind farm issue. I guess I knew that the Sussex Council had basically said, we're not doing it. But I guess I didn't know that there was a movement afoot in the state legislature to sort of override that, which, again, I support 100%, not just in this issue, which I support 100%, but anytime any local podunk government does something, they should just override it, but that's at the state level. So I agree with all of that. But can you give some background about what's happening and maybe a little bit of information about how the first hearing went last week?
Oh, yeah. So the first hearing went, I thought it went fairly well. It was about even in commentary, probably a little bit more in favor of the bill than against. The argument that you keep hearing from opponents of the bill is that somehow local control is more important than what's good for the state. And I think the message it hasn't gotten out yet, but is this, that U.S. Wind did a detailed analysis of just 1 hour during the cold snap last winter and the effect it would have had on utility prices. And they found in just that 1 hour, it would have saved Delaware ratepayers over $1 million. And that cold snap lasted 750 hours. It is probably in the neighborhood of 40% that would have been saved on energy costs during that cold snap if that had been connected at Indian River. So it is costing and hurting every Delawarean and all the people in my district. And if they think it's local control, how would they feel if Newcastle County decided that, well, the gas lines that and the pressurization stations, the compression stations needed to pump all the gas down to southern Delaware that all run through Newcastle County don't help Newcastle County. So we shouldn't approve that infrastructure. It's ridiculous. Energy that flows across the state should not be controlled by one local entity. And it's the same as if you could dam up the creek for the town downstream and you just say, well, we're not going to let it flow. It's ridiculous and it's hurting every Delawarean.
Yeah, and I guess the argument now is local control. Same as, sort of like the Seaford LLC votes and all of that stuff. But local control to do what? It's like, what was the reason? Okay. Was it an aesthetic thing? Like what? I don't understand the moratorium to begin with, I guess, is what was the, when do we know a lot about the fight in Sussex County to get it to stop? Is this just moneyed interest? Is this just utility interest? I mean, how did that, what was the impetus behind that move to try to stop it there?
It was largely Caesar Rodney Institute.
Oh, classic.
Yes.
Oh, hold
classic,
on.
Yes.
Yes. Yes.
Caesar Rodney Institute and David Stevenson, who works for Caesar Rodney, was one of the big pushers of this. The actual zoning board had approved it unanimously. After being approved by the zoning board, it went in front of the county commission. There was a lot of, and not only that, one of the counties in Maryland spent over $100,000 trying to influence the outcome in Sussex County. So this was a very...
Under what, what is their interest in it?
Their interest is they don't like offshore wind. There are some... Okay, this goes back to, I don't know if you remember many years back, there was someone who owns a golf course in Scotland who was incensed that they were putting an offshore wind farm off the coast of where his golf course was. And yeah, this particular...
I know this individual.
Yes, this particular individual has led his party down this anti-offshore wind on this anti-offshore wind crusade, which continues to this day. And you know, one of the interesting things is now they try to couch it in some sort of environmental thing, but the Caesar Rodney Institute and Dave Stevenson was the person who signed it, put out a press release not that many years ago lauding the idea of drilling for oil off the Delaware coast in the mid-Atlantic. So I mean, you know, now they're trying to pretend that they're caring about the environment.
So I guess that, yeah, their interest is just the established energy interests.
Yes.
And that's it.
Yeah.
That is really something. Just because, you know, we make fun of the Caesar Rodney Institute, and we're going to continue to do that because they're easy to make fun of. And the ISI too, the Intercollegiate Studies Institute, another like a reactionary think tank in Delaware. But the idea that, and I guess you can do it because, as you said, there's actually two prongs. There's this weird libertarian sort of right-wing reactionary business prong and just trying to prop up the status quo, basically, because all your money is tied up in fossil fuels. And then there's the Trump sort of Scotland example about, you know, if he just doesn't like it, then it's just something he doesn't like now. And then that becomes like a thing.
Yep.
He doesn't like that. So we don't like it either.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess I do understand that. Well, here's the proposal as it stands now. What does that look like? Like how many windmills, where would they be, and how would it work if this goes ahead?
Okay. So, it's actually mostly off of Maryland. And I think it's about 170 windmills. And the Delaware part of it is that the cables would come in and connect in at Indian River Power Plant. But that energy then feeds directly into Delmarva's local power supply. So even though and it gets complicated, the renewable energy credits go to Maryland because Maryland's agreed to purchase power and everything in this project, but the actual energy comes into Delaware, which is why we would have saved so much money in last winter's cold snap if it had already been connected, and why if we don't get it connected in future cold snaps, we're going to be getting hit again and again with, you know, several hundred dollar energy bills that we would not need to endure if this is connected.
How far off the coast of, I guess, of Ocean City and would it be?
I'll have to look. I think it's 17 to 20 miles. I can't remember right now.
Well, because I was going to say, I love the aesthetic argument. I can't see anything, so that's not really my issue. But but 17 miles, even in a clear day, seems like it's past the horizon almost.
Well, you would see them in the far distance. On a clear day with no humidity and no mist out over the ocean.
See little sticks out there.
You would see them, and you know they're not looming. They're not large.
At that distance, they must look just like little sticks.
Yeah, and you know, it's. I always think of it this way. First of all, it's never at the places where they have wind farms. It has not caused a decrease in tourism, and these are older wind farms that are closer to shore. Hasn't caused any decrease in tourism, hasn't caused any drop in home values. So all of the arguments that they're trying to make, they have no data to back them up. They're just, theoretically, they're saying this would, and it's not, it just hasn't happened.
Yeah, that's a classic Delaware thing too, but I guess it's kind of like, I won't ring the bell on that one because I guess it happens a lot of places, but I think of it relative to the cannabis question too. It's like, we sit here and regurgitate these arguments from like our feelings and pretend like everybody else isn't already doing this stuff. Like, okay, there's been wind farms offshore for decades. You know, this doesn't happen. You know, you're just making it up.
Essentially.
But you're making it up in the interest of you're already, you know, you already are invested in basically the extraction, the usage and delivery of fossil fuels.
Right.
And that's it.
But you're scaring people, and it goes back to the same thing with SB 21. Fear works. You're making people fear for their property values, fear for their businesses that depend on tourism. You can use fear, and that is a very potent weapon politically. And that's what's been used here. It's irrational fear, but it's fear.
What else is going on? What can we expect? Can we expect anything these last couple of weeks of the session? Can we expect something good?
Well, I think there's some good things happening, but they're not. One good thing that's not controversial that I'm involved in is the anti-SLAPP legislation, which is it prevents targeted litigation against people who participate in public meetings and things like that. What's happened is people who are rich and have resources have used lawsuits against people who speak up in public forums as a way of silencing them.
On what grounds?
It doesn't really matter because the lawsuit itself is the punishment that someone has to defend themselves. But it could be if something's brought up, they have sued people for invasion of privacy, slander, you know, many, many different things. But Spiros introduced the bill in the Senate. It's Senate Bill 80. And that one is from sort of the uniform law group that comes up with things to try to, but that's an interesting one because it's backed by both ACLU and the Caesar Rodney Institute.
Yeah. Let me ask you this, since you're involved in this, can I get a carve out? Cause as Carl knows, I have tried to get sued. I think that would be a big boon to the podcast and my reputation, to get sued. I'd love to go to a discovery and get all the information on these little cretins that would sue me. So maybe you could just do one, put my name in as one carve out. If you want to sue me for something, just me personally on one of these grounds, I would love that.
Yeah, I don't know if it's probably too late it's Damn already it. Past the Senate. It'd be too late to get an amendment.
I saw Spiros last night at the Greek Festival too. God
yes,
damn it.
Everybody but Rob Vanella.
Yeah, look, if somebody wants to sue me for slander, we'll go right to court. We'll have a nice discovery process. We'll get all your emails. We'll find out all about you.
Yeah. The other, so I guess the only one that's sort of, the whole, I seethe over the whole school meals situation.
You're going to weigh in here now on the school meals?
All I'm going to say is, we have a program that is really one of the most, to me, regressive things Delaware does, and that's beach nourishment, where they every year basically throw the money in the ocean by replenishing the sand that's going to wash away next winter on the beaches in southern Delaware. So the people who are well off and the people who are well off enough to go and vacation down at the shore can have fun. And although there's a big federal contribution in that, the state always seems to have money to nourish beaches. And we don't have money to nourish children. And that is pathetic.
I love that argument. I never thought of that particular thing. But yeah, they just more sand on the beach that you're going to lose just so people can walk into
it. And they term it beach nourishment, which is sort of the...
Yeah, can you nourish a beach? I mean, I don't know. I don't think so. Yeah, that's a funny little euphemism. Yeah, I mean, once again, we find ourselves arguing about whether we should feed kids or not. I assume you know the fiscal crisis that was looming. We don't have it. I don't know if that were you like shocked by that? Were you like, wow? I thought we don't. Oh. Were you like, wow, we don't have it?
No.
I didn't think so.
No, I was okay. People are expecting federal cuts for this, and this. And, they might happen. But right now, there was nothing to indicate we were in bad shape. I mean, the DFAC had not sent up any warnings or bells. This was another, you know, I don't know, fear that the sky is falling kind of thing. And whether it was intentionally generated or just, you know, kind of developed its own head of steam somehow, I don't know. But, that was unfortunate. But I really do think we need to not operate on assumptions that are fear-based rather than fact-based.
Yeah, and again, we'll just go at it next year, and we'll point out the fact that everybody fell for it again. You all got tricked again. And if you try it next year, we're gonna call you out. I mean, it's just what we're gonna do. So, Frank, thank you for coming in.
Well, thank you.
I have to ask you one final fun question because, and this was mentioned a couple of weeks ago. A friend of mine, Mr. C, was in here, and when he found out my name was Rob Vanilla back when he first met me, he thought it was hilarious. And of course, I said, like, well, I've had to live with this name my whole life, so I've heard them all. So anybody with a name that can be sort of there's a play on words or something. But did you get the MASH? I mean, we're old enough. Did you get MASH? The guy imagine you're like, oh, are you the surgeon from
all the time? Maybe. But I will tell you that when I went to the seminary, you know, as a Catholic, you can't be baptized with a name that's not a saint's name. So my birth certificate is Frank Richard Burns. My baptismal certificate is Richard Frank Burns. And when I went into the seminary, they put my baptized name on all my documentation for high school and things. So through most of the worst of it, when I was at school, I got called Rich. So
okay, that so kind got of, out of it. You got out of it.
But, you know, once I left, it was, you know, okay, Frank again. And then I once did go to a party with someone we weren't dating. We just drove to a
party. Was her name Hot Lips Houlihan?
No.
Okay.
It was Mary Hartman.
Really?
Yes.
That's incredible.
And, you know, Loretta Swit passed away this week. So.
Oh, did she really?
Yes, she did.
I did
so
not know.
So Hot Lips is.
Hot Lips, just RIP to a real one.
Yeah.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was what a show.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought maybe you could do the Francis thing, and then you're Francis, but you're just Frank.
Yeah,
you're
I'm not, just Frank, just not Frank. Francis, yeah.
Well, I'm glad there was something there. I do appreciate the name thing. Obviously, I appreciate it very personally. It's very personal to me. As I told Mr. C, when Vanilla Ice came out with Ice Ice Baby, it wasn't a great year for me.
Yeah, well, you know, I figured you and Carl would, like, do a duet.
Oh, Christ almighty. Can you imagine that? See, that's the thing, too, is Carl, both of Carl's parents are artists. They're musicians.
Uh-huh.
And but I don't know if Carl's like a singer or I know, you know, Pleasant doesn't play an instrument or anything. I think it skips a generation or something. I don't know. Is that what it is?
Yeah.
Well, folks, we've once again done it. We've produced another humdinger. Another just hit show with somebody, a very influential person here, Representative Frank Burns. Frank, thanks again for joining. Carl, thanks again for everything you do. And, everybody, left is best.